Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Leslie Young on the show. Leslie is a Fresno native with a master's degree from Pepperdine and is a dynamic entrepreneur and educator making waves in the small business consulting industry. She founded MVM Advisory Group during the COVID-19 pandemic, which focuses on helping small and medium-sized enterprises grow through strategic development and emotional intelligence methodologies. Leslie's impact extends to over 400 small businesses, various nonprofits, and educational initiatives, including designing a course at UCSD and supporting the Mexican Consulate in San Diego with a business certificate program. Balancing her professional success with family life as a wife and a mother of three, Leslie continues to inspire women in business while pursuing her passions. I had a great time talking with Leslie. She had a lot of incredible insights on management, development, consulting, and much more. I know you'll love this conversation. Let's go meet Leslie. Convos to elevate guests, politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best. Fresno's best. Leslie, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
I really like any place that has good sushi. So for a long time, my husband and I ate at I Heart Sushi near Shaw and Clovis. And lately, we've been having a lot of sushi at Takumi's. But I also like a lot of authentic Mexican foods. But that's mostly where you'll find me. It's either dabbling in sushi or some Mexican authentic place.
Okay. And what do you mean by Mexican authentic?
Just real Mexican food. So you have like handmade tortillas or like actual refried beans that are being like fried and refried in the back of the kitchen. They're not being opened from a can and heated up to give to serve on the plate. We always know and we always find the good spots and we just keep coming to those same spots.
It really does make a difference. I don't know, it was like a week ago, I slow cooked pork shoulder in lard for 3 or 4 hours and then broiled the pork shoulder to crisp it up, like carnitas basically. And at first my wife was pretty skeptical of me cooking pork shoulder and lard for that long, but when she tasted it, she understood. And so I think you can really tell if there's some love in those refried beans or not, because refried beans can go one of two very different directions, be incredible or just be, I don't know, feel like cafeteria food almost.
Yeah, 100%. And I actually grew up, I'm first gen, so I grew up in a very traditional Mexican home. What we ate every single day as I was a child, when I was a little girl, were refried beans and some type of protein. It was always refried beans and some type of protein. So now as I'm older, it's not so good for you. So I don't even know how to make them, but I do know a good set of cooked refried beans.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about a bunch of business related topics today. And I want to start by talking about education and background as a starting place. You've received degrees in business and are now teaching the subject in a university context. What do you think are some of the things that you learned in the classroom that you can't learn just starting a business yourself? In other words, what I'm asking is, what's the value add from studying business in an academic context as opposed to just jumping in and starting your own business?
I think the plethora of concepts and theories that you learn that may not necessarily be applicable when you're starting out a business. It's very linear, right? Like you have the concept of the business idea, the industry you're going to go into, and the strategy that you're going to use to go forth. But you're very limited, right? Because it's very narrow. It's just that your focus is in. And so sometimes because of the lack of breadth in theory and concept and knowledge and information, we are limited to the decision making, right? And the creative process in that strategy. And so I think for me, one of the biggest things was going through my educational experience was really trying to challenge myself to immerse in different situations and circumstances in the theories that could potentially be and how I would respond and react. I have to tell you, when I was going through my educational experience and I was at Pepperdine when I actually obtained my master's, I did not really know that what the future would have in store for me would be helping small businesses with strategy or medium-sized enterprises with strategy as well. I had a passion for leadership. And so that was my thing. My thing was, I love leading people. I love the way that we get things done, right? There's something I'm doing right. However, I don't know how to teach what I'm doing right. And that's where that question came, where it's, I feel like I'm missing something and I don't really know what it is that I'm missing. My husband and I are like this. We're about two peas in a pod as it relates to business. And we're always mentoring to each other back and forth and being each other's soundboard. I remember saying that to him consistently. And that's what really led the trajectory of me wanting to get my master's, because I felt like I was missing something. And because of my passion in leadership, I really wanted to study not just the science of leadership, but also the science of the management piece, because I felt like that's where I really wanted to hone in. I'm doing this really well, but I don't know what this is. I know it's called leadership, but what is it made out of? What does it consist of that I can then put together, articulate, put it on a training curriculum, develop it, teach it to my team, develop my team in a way that now I can define it. And I would say that I think that sometimes there's a lot of different opinions right now in our current day and age because of the abundance of information that people say, oh, you don't necessarily need an education to be able to do this successfully. And I think that I don't think that there's a right or wrong answer. I think that it really just depends on the questions you're trying to answer. But I think for me personally, if I could make that suggestion to any entrepreneur or small business owner, it's really like, you're going to be out in the trenches and you're going to learn a lot, right? With the business that you're going to open and try to execute on. But to have a plethora of books and case studies and exercises and how you would maximize that strategy, how you would manage the cost management, how you would decrease your operations costs by 10-15%. And you're only limited to being able to work with minimizing these are two, three things, these variables in your company. These are things that unless you're going through it, you're not going to have the experience to think through that. So I think, again, there's no right or wrong answer, but I think for me personally, I always encourage the education piece. If there's not enough that you can learn so that you as an entrepreneur and as the owner of your business can be dynamic, be creative, and be constantly up to date with what is working in the marketplace.
Yeah, I have these conversations with people a lot because college is really expensive now. And so encouraging someone to pursue an education is encouraging them to make a large investment in themselves, which I think investing in yourselves generally is a good practice. But I do think some people jump in not knowing why they're making that decision, but they're making that decision because that's just a societal, like it's a path that's been laid out versus I'm coming in to learn X. But then I also think too, if you're a sole proprietor and you're trying to make business decisions in a vacuum by yourself, that can be pretty isolating. It might be hard if you don't have an education to know where to go to find answers, but then also to have the opportunity to hear other people and how they troubleshoot problems. I think that's a super valuable thing beyond just what you read or the books. I'm curious if what was something that wasn't part of your business education in the university context that you wish was there that would be useful to what you're doing now?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a really good question. I think so. My experience is a little bit unique because my experience required in my master's specifically for us to go through a series of consulting projects where we actually served as consultants for several nonprofits. So we actually went through, had a conversation with the CEO or whoever was in charge about challenges they were having. And we served as that facilitator and that strategist, right? Where we're gathering the information, we're the ones doing market analysis, we're doing the studying, we're doing the research. And then we're coming back to the CEO and we're saying, these are our suggestions and this is why it's backed up by this. Then the CEO would put them into place and come back and give us feedback. This is what's working, this is what's not working. So I remember that was one of my biggest fears because I didn't want my experience, especially with master, again, to your point, right? It's a very expensive degree. And so for you to go through that and only focus on theory, that was not my aim. So my experience is a little bit different from that context because that is what I desired. I really wanted to make sure that I had real experience, real tangible experience. And I was able to do just that. I think that one of the things that we did focus, going back to your question as I'm processing this, one of the things that we did focus on a lot was self-awareness. So in the context in which we were learning leadership, we focused a lot on self-awareness. However, I think that we did not, I wish that we would have gone more in depth. That is one area that I learned now currently, which is one of the biggest, it's actually the foundational methodology of our consulting firm, is emotional intelligence, because we learned a lot about self-awareness, but we didn't learn and go too far in depth about the lack of emotional intelligence in small businesses and how that would be really and truly a deterrent in their inability to grow, especially because of how difficult small businesses are seeing hiring people right now because of the differences in generational workforce. And so I think diving a little bit further into that, into what we were going to be seeing, what was trending in terms of expectations with the generations and how people have a natural craving to have a social emotional connection. And so the more that we're leaning on technology, sometimes we forget that human piece as the most critical. And so we touched on the leadership part in my education, but we didn't necessarily go into the impacts of what is to come. And so that's something that I do focus on a lot in our firm. We're always reading, we're always studying. And so I would say that, but I think again, in my response to you, I think my experience is a little unique because we were out in the trenches doing the work we were studying, we were putting it into action. And so I think that's also what makes the difference between like a master in arts or a master in science, especially as it relates to business.
Yeah. On that same subject, if you're not attending a highly ranked business school, do you think it's still worth it to pursue an MBA?
Absolutely.
The average cost of an MBA right now is about $62,000. And that's assuming that's on the low end, I think. I don't know what the median is, but I think that's on the low end. So you think it's still a worthwhile investment?
When this is subjective, I would say yes. If it's in your plans, you're able to afford it, you can project out that you can maximize on that return of investment. But I think as we're in this conversation right now, I think that if you are an entrepreneur or you're a small business owner and maybe pursuing an MBA is not something that is in the plans for you, right? Maybe you're being a little bit conservative. You're trying to really make sure that you're stabilizing your business, but you do want to learn a few things and you want to make sure that you're constantly educating yourself. There are so many resources, right? In workshops, for example, with the SBA, the example, one that I partner with closely, Fresno Area Hispanic Foundation, Central Valley Women Entrepreneur Center, which title says women, but they're not limited to helping any small business owner. And I actually participate in hosting workshops for them where we're teaching and we're talking about some very specific topics as they relate to business administration, right? So that means business accounting, that means idea creation, that means budgeting and forecasting, cost management. So these are things that typically, I mean, we're trying to get this high level information to you all within an hour, right? We're giving you exercises for you to learn, et cetera, but we're not going to be able to cover everything. But I would tell you there are many resources out there for those that aren't able to, they're not necessarily in a position where they can secure a master's education or something to that degree, that they can still continue on that. Because I think that being in business, it's a learning game, right? It never stops. So for us to have the idea that, you know, I'm an entrepreneur or I'm a small business owner and I've learned what I needed to know, that's never the case. Then it never stops. So I think the MBA provides a very robust foundation for you. But I also think that there are free resources. There's books, you know, that you can maximize. YouTube now has so much information, right, where you're taking some very complex frameworks of strategy, right? One of the ones that we hear commonly is like the SWOT analysis that a lot of MBA students study. I studied it in my master's as well. And we went in depth and we learned the background and the history and different case studies of how it was used and different ways you could use it. But at a very high level, I can teach you SWOT analysis very quickly and you can be on your way in the next hour and be able to do a very solid strength weaknesses, opportunities, and threats for your company and be able to carve out a strategy, right? So there's so much information out there. I think if you have the ability to do it, perhaps I would recommend it absolutely. But again, it's subjective. I have a passion for learning. And again, I think that just focusing on the fact that you're going to be in a learning, it's a learning lifestyle when you're an entrepreneur and a business owner. I think that as long as you have the focus and intention to continue to learn, doesn't matter where you're getting the information, right? As long as it's a trustworthy source.
Great. Let's jump into some business management questions. What is one sacred belief or dogma in business management you wish we could let go of?
Okay, this is a good one. So I actually, this was one of mine when I first started in my corporate career, and it was create a solid operation and you won't manage people, you will manage processes. And that's terrible, right? Like now, as I say it out loud, I'm like, oh my gosh, but it's part of the growth, right? It's part of the growth. I think I was 21 years old as a corporate manager, Jordan. Imagine that, right? I was the youngest out of everyone to ever be a branch manager. So I, even though I had some very natural, like intuition of decision-making and I had the experience and I was really good at what I did, I lacked some of that, the experience, right? And so for me, it was safer. And for many managers, even now, it's still safe to play it by managing processes, standardization, and just keeping an eye out on your operation rather than focusing on the person, right? And we're seeing such a downtrend in that because we need that connection. It's, you know, I mentioned this earlier. It's like, it's part of being in business. We're going to need to understand that people need to be heard and people want to be acknowledged and they want to be empowered and they want to be inspired by the mission of your organization or your small business. And that is one that I would say, gosh, guys, as much as I love it and as much as it's necessary for you to have an efficient operation, it's not sustainable if that's the way that we're managing our business without bringing in the human component along. So
on that note, do you think, and this is a general question, do you think that more managers should be firing and hiring more regularly?
That's a good question. No, I actually think that the focus should be more on the hiring process. So I wouldn't say necessarily that there should be more hiring and firing going on. I think that we, and I don't have the answer for this. I think my husband and I have constant conversations about new strategies that they're incorporating for their global manufacturing site. And we talk about this often. How can we get to know someone in such an early short window of time and really make sure we're betting on the right person? And I don't necessarily think that we're even close to figuring that out, but I think that we're getting closer. I think that the more time we spend in the hiring process, right, whether we're full, and we're seeing now a huge shift, right, where before everything was, this person has 20 years of experience, we need to bring them along. It doesn't matter if I jive with, or they jive with the personality of the group they're going to be working with, they come with the experience. And now we're seeing a shift where companies are saying, wait a minute, how does their personality match up to the personality group that we have in the team that they're going to be working with? And so as it relates to skill set, if they're limited to something specific, a technical skill that they need to learn or they don't necessarily possess, our job as leadership is to make sure that we can equip them with that training so that they can develop on that technical skill. And so we're seeing a lot of that, right? Where companies are starting to say, how can we get smarter about the time we're spending in the hiring process? And I think that's the way to go. And again, I don't think that we're close to figuring that out, but I think taking those personality assessments and, you know, bringing those potential candidates out to lunch with you, not once, but several times, having them do some shadow work, include them in the problem solving. I'll share this brief story with you here. One of the most impactful interviews I ever had was, and I'll mention his name. He knows that he's someone I truly admire. His name's Tyler Dickinson. And it's when I spent my time working for a company, franchise company called Coverall. And during my interview process with him, Jordan, what he did is he actually brought me along in the problem solving. So we did maybe 30 minutes of a debrief with challenges that he was having in that department. And maybe the next 30 minutes, he brought me in the conversation and said, this is what I've been thinking about doing, and just left it open for me to start jumping in the conversation. And I was asking questions. Why does that make sense? Or how is that going to impact X? And we went through that process, and the whole interview was a collaborative effort. I think he was trying to gauge whether he can work with me and whether my personality worked well along with his or his leadership style. And I ended up getting the job. So it wasn't anything about the conversation had nothing to do with my abilities to do the job. He wanted to engage in the actual deliverance of what that ability could look like potentially in his department. And so, again, I thought that was so unique. I thought it was creative. I've never sat in an interview like that. And I share that constantly when I have workshops, and I challenge entrepreneurs and small business owners to do the same, because we've got to spend a little bit more time in the hiring process so that we're not in that cycle of the hiring firing. Right? I think I read some fact, it's been a few years, but I think it might've been something like the average cost that it takes to bring someone in their first 90 days, no matter for what organization it is, it's an average of $6,000 per month. So you're talking about $12,000 in a 90-day period that if this person doesn't work out, you're out $6,000 if they don't work out in the first 30 days anyway, right? And we're just talking about an average size cost. So that's something to think about. So again, we've got to be very intentional about the time we're spending in each.
When you're looking at a stack of resumes, what is the most useful thing that you find in a resume as an indicator of a quality employee, and what's the least useful?
That's really difficult. I would tell you that for me, I'd like to see resumes that tell a story. So it's almost like a compounding development of problem solving. We're hiring problem solvers, right? That's what we're doing. We're hiring folks that can add value to the organization. But essentially what we're doing is, no matter for what, if it's a products-based company or a service-based company, what we're doing is we're solving problems, right? And so we want to see that development and what that looks like progressively through the document. And for me, that's what stands out. It's, can I see how you took on new things to work on, harder challenges, were responsible for maybe a larger group of people? What did the cross collaboration look like, if there was any? And so I like to see that progressive effort to continue to make impact in an organization. And again, it depends, but I think at a high level, if I'm looking for someone who's really going to make a dent in what we're trying to do, that's what we look for. If we're looking for someone that is going to add value in a position for a very long period of time, then of course we're looking for something a little different. But if you just tell me right now, if you know what I'm looking for specifically and what stands out to me is that, and everything's subjective. It really just depends on what we're filling the role for and a series of other things. But I think it's that progressive story developing over time in the resume.
And what's the least useful part that people should just, their eyes should just glaze over? Like a list of strengths and skills? Because those can be vague, right?
Honestly, yes. I still see sometimes resumes that have Microsoft Word and Microsoft, like Excel. And it's if you're a mid-senior, mid-level, or depending on the role you're applying for, that comes with the package, right? It takes up space that can be used for something else. And I think, again, for me, it's that storytelling. How can I tell a story in one page?
Yeah.
Or page and a half? Yeah, I would say that list of technical skills, unless you're hiring for a very technical role. But still, I think keeping those limited and seeing that progressive. And I always like to see numbers too, like was able to increase from X time to X time by reducing X costs. And numbers are always fun because then I have something to draw on when we're asking questions.
So my next question is a two-part question. What steps should a company take before hiring a business consultant? Sometimes companies get into a rut and they just feel like before they do any kind of internal reflection, or they just say, all right, let's just throw $50,000 and hire a consultant. So I guess my first part of my question is what steps would you recommend before someone spends the money on a consultant? And then secondly, if you were the CEO of a company that hired a consultant, how would you evaluate whether those consultants were effective or not for you?
Great question. So I think the first part is a two-part response. So I would always encourage any organization to do an internal assessment. And that internal assessment is assessing a few things. Your resource capability right now, right? So sometimes we may have the talent that we need, and right now they're currently in another department, or they're currently assisting on a different project, or maybe they've got insight and they're not using that experience that they've previously have a certificate on. And so I would really do an assessment with our internal resources. What do we have right now that maybe we're not necessarily maximizing. And then the second part is, in that, as part of that internal assessment, is identifying, right? When we do the first part of the internal assessment, we're really looking at, is there a gap that we need to fill, right? Is there a lack of understanding? We've hit a roadblock and we really don't have the resources to be able to overcome this. We're tapped out. And this happens a lot. But the second piece I would tell you is, there are some organizations, and I've worked for a few, that we're not necessarily ready for a consultant. And you may be asking, what does that mean? It means that not everyone is aligned with what we're trying to accomplish in terms of the mission, right? So then people might be part of a team and they may say, yes, we really want to make sure that we can solidify this sales department and get it to another level. And what we've been seeing is not working. Okay, but what does that mean for you in operations?
Yeah, right? Let me jump in real quick. From your perspective, how often are consultants just used as people giving license to operators to do the things that they already know they should be doing?
Oh, honestly, I'm going to tell you, I've seen that a lot in my experience. And sometimes it's because the CEO doesn't want to be the hard hand to make those hard decisions. But exactly to my point, what I'm referencing is, like, sometimes the organization, even if you want that to happen as the CEO, you've not equipped or prepared your company to have a consultant come in. So then what happens is there starts to become silos. Silos start to be formed within the organization internally about why or if this potential strategy is going to work and why not. And not knowing, right, that 80% of that strategy was already carved out by the CEO. And what we're doing is we're saying, that makes sense. Let me look at it and analyze it with you. We're asking some hard questions, and maybe there was a shift of a few things here and there. And maybe the integration slows down a little bit and the project tracking is a little different, but overall it's already something that was going to be put forth. And so what tends to happen is the CEO or the leadership at this organization almost is not themselves ready to continue that commitment, right? And so they're saying, well, lean on the consultant. They're the ones with the experience and expertise. So it can be very difficult. It can be challenging at times. So, you know, without diverting, I would say that to the answer of your first question, doing the internal assessment and then also making sure that your team is actually ready for a consultant to come in, that they're all sold, they're all bought in on what needs to happen by all means necessary, right? And the second question that you asked me about, how would I assess a consultant and know whether they were effective? That's a tough one too, because I would want to tell the consultant what my problem is or what the roadblock is that I'm hitting, and have them give me a backdrop and of understanding as to why this may have occurred, what led me here, because that will allow for me to understand whether they have experience in what I'm facing or they have an understanding of the people interacting with my operation and how this has led us here, what our limitations have been. And that in itself allows for me to feel that level, that would feel, make me feel that level of security with that consultant. What we see, and I've been on both sides, right? So I've worked with a company that hired in a consultant, actually two companies that hired a consultant. And the first consultant had a very unique strategy where she wanted to create very interpersonal relationships with us as it related to the business. So she wanted to build that relationship of trust and honesty and support. The other consultant experience that I had was a little bit unique because it was all regurgitated by the book. So it was almost like, this is what we know needs to happen. And this is what we've seen companies do. And this is what you guys are going to do to make it happen. You're right. And without, again, the understanding of where we've been, how we even got here, you know, what it took for us to get here, the limitations we've had up until this point, the dynamics of the team and the different personalities and in the growth, the rapid growth of the company or whatever those dynamics are. And so that can be challenging. So I always know, right, this is a by the book response or this is a by the book. And when we would ask those hard questions, I remember we would get a very generic response pointing back to the strategy they were recommending for us, as opposed to validating the problem and validating previous decisions that led here. And that for me is a big thing. It's, I want to make sure I meet you where you're at, not where we're trying to go, but where you're at, and really understand where we've been as I'm collaborating with you, because that's where we build that trust, where I can truly understand things that your strategies we're going to put forth that are going to allow for you to not go back to what you've done before, and that we're both very clear, both organization and myself, about why we're doing what we're doing and why it's different than what you've done in the past. So there's almost, again, everything's progressive, but I would tell you that if I can share that with a consultant, tell them my problem, and if I was to ask them those open-ended questions about how I got there and they didn't have a good response for me, I would probably not hire them.
Yeah, it's such a complicated topic. And I think about the role that survivorship bias plays in all this, where you go to a consultant's website and they'll highlight the businesses that they worked with that were successful. And then the ones that maybe didn't land will be either pushed to the side or just not included in any way. And it seems like a situation where if a business is successful after receiving your consulting services, you can say, oh, that was due to my consulting services. If it fails, you could say something along the lines of, they didn't really implement the plan that I laid out for them. And so really it's on them. And so it feels like such a difficult field to evaluate. And businesses need help, so they need to wade into this morass of business consulting, but it just seems so hard to evaluate efficacy from my perspective.
Yeah. And I think it's almost like the way that I like to think of it is there's some business, and I'll share from my experience, there's some businesses that you work with where leadership is very transparent and they're willing to go all the way with you. Like, I messed up because what I said to her when X thing happened was X. Right. And I know that now, but since then, X thing has happened and this has evolved. And now this, so they're very vulnerable and transparent in their collaboration. And there are some leaders that they're very clear about what they need. And in that clarity, there's not necessarily vulnerability, but just factual asks, right? Like, they're just stating, this is the problem that I need solved, and this is what I expect for you to come in and do. And so I like very much to be very clear about the expectation for me as the consultant. It's almost like, you know, this word consultant gives the indication that I'm to do your job for you, right? Like, I'm the one being hired to do whatever X is for you.
Yeah.
What I'll tell you is that the types of roles that I pick up on as a consultant, it's almost like I should be called a business advisor, because the consultant roles that I take on are project driven. And so that means that, for example, if I'm going to develop a strategy on building a business development department, and this business development department is going to help your outside sales team be more equipped and spend more time closing deals. And so my role is to come in and identify whether there is a gap, be able to do the market research, and provide the outline of how we're going to be able to develop a business development department. So you've got these internal inside sales folks that are making the calls, not your closing people, right? Just to give you an example. So that is a very project-driven task, right, that I'm being asked to do as a consultant. And so there is no confusion about whether that's effective or not. Whether you did the market study, whether this fits in our plan, does it fit in the budget? And that's it, right? In terms of putting together hiring documents or job descriptions or hosting interviews, right? That's all based off of the study of your company, et cetera. Again, another project-driven type of task. But there are, as a business consultant, projects that I get hired on to do that is more strategic advising. And that means that I help you with the analyzing of wherever you're at and in whatever strategy you're trying to execute upon. And my role is to ask the hard questions and to ensure that if you've put forth a strategy together already, if I can identify gaps, I want to be able to do that. And I want to make sure that I'm being that person that is checking your blind side, that I'm looking for those things that maybe you're not thinking about as you're thinking about the business day in and day out, because your focus is being here when I'm coming in as a third party from a third party perspective, and I can offer a different viewpoint. And so it's almost like a mixture of the two, right? And I know exactly what you're saying, and I know how difficult it can be, but I will tell you that as a business owner and as a CEO, if you were to hire a business consultant, only the level of efficiency of that consultant right? And in that continuous partnership or what they were able to provide for you through you seeking them out. One thing I will also add though is that as a consultant or business advisor, as I mentioned earlier, that I always encourage small business owners or even emerge like business owners that are ready to take their business to the next level, is I always feel that having a business advisor as part of your strategy is super important. And the reason for that is because I use my husband as my example, right? Because he's my mentor. But if I didn't have my husband as my mentor, I wouldn't be as efficient at what I do because I'm allowing somebody else to come in and offer me a perspective on my process. And what tends to happen is sometimes I've seen in organizations where when we do this, we trust other leadership members to be able to offer us that type of mentorship or offer that type of support in our creative process. And again, it's still very subjective because they're only seeing it from their standpoint, right? From their own silo or own, their own bubble of what they're seeing day in and day out. And so again, having someone to come in that is familiar with different industries and how different things have worked for different people, different industries, different processes, and offer a different insight or even just validate or reinforce what you're trying to do, I think is super important. And it gives a different level of confidence, right? Because again, ultimately it's up to you as the leadership to execute on that. But to be able to have someone else to say, does this make sense? And how does this not make sense? Help me be the devil's advocate here, right? If worst case scenario is what? Help me see what the worst case scenario of this is. And it's hard to find that type of honesty within teams. And again, I always encourage it because for me, I think it has proved to be extremely pivotal. And for the organizations that I've partnered with that I still continue to do business with, they offer the same insight where it's, I didn't think about it that way. I come to you sometimes, Leslie, because I just want to make sure I'm on the right track. And that's something, right? For someone that needs, especially as a small business owner, entrepreneurs, we have to make very fast decisions and we can't delay. So we've got to have some type of, sometimes we're going to go through it without having that counsel or advice, but if we can have some counsel or advice, I would encourage you to have it. And again, sometimes most of those counsel sessions are free. The SBA offers them, right? The organizations I mentioned earlier that are nonprofits also offer them where you can speak with an advisor and just bounce back ideas. You don't necessarily have to pay, you know, a certain budget to have someone come into your organization and do that for you. But I definitely have seen the value in it.
Okay, we're going to jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of stuff at you. You tell me whether you think it's over or underrated and why. We'll do this rapid fire, so just quick back and forth. Yeah. So the first one is the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. Do you think that book is over or underrated?
I think it's overrated.
Okay, why?
Oh, why?
Yeah, why?
Why? Again, we're talking about some, I think some of the strategies that were mentioned in that book are very linear in nature, right? We're trying to influence people, but they're very linear. And I think the world has changed so much that it's more about, not so much about how we're trying to manipulate situations or circumstances to win in those circles, but more about how we're staying true to ourselves and being the most authentic version of ourselves to be in the right circle, right? Not the one that everyone says we need to be in or win the people that we need to win, but the ones that are right for us.
Okay. Next one, online universities.
Look, I'm going to tell you, I finished my bachelor in arts at an online university because like I mentioned, I was 21 as a branch manager. So when I got promoted, I couldn't finish at Fresno State. I had to do something online. And I would argue that it's absolutely harder to do the online work than it is to show up every day. And so I would say it's underrated.
Yep. I agree with that. And I've been through some online programs. Next one, the show Undercover Boss, over or underrated?
Overrated.
Okay. Why?
Just because of the lack of authenticity, like the measures you have to go through to find out what your team is actually doing. I think, again, we're going back to what used to work and the measures we would have to take and what actually is going to take for it to work now. And it's something very different than it took from us before. So I'm never a fan of anything that puts you in a position to be caught red-handed, you know, puts you in a position where, I mean, you have cameras for that, right? You don't have to, anyway. So yeah, I think it's overrated.
Yeah, it seems like if you're on that show, that's just a signal that you have really poor communication at your company. It's really, so it's like you're throwing
Absolutely.
yourself under the bus on TV. And so for the life of me, I don't understand why people go on that show. Next one, Me and Ed's Pizza.
Oh, absolutely underrated. I love it. I will forever love Mia and Ed's pizza. It was the first pizza that I ever had that was, what do they call it? The pizza baked in an actual pizza like oven. And I'll never forget it. And I don't know, I personally still feel like there's some kind of ingredient that they're withholding in what they use for their ranch. I've never been able to find ranch that tastes like Mia and Ed's ranch. So
Yeah.
I, for those two reasons, it's I can never find any pizza, no matter if it's a pizza baked oven, to come out the same. And the ranch in itself is just the those two combinations, just I don't think they're beatable.
Okay. Next one. Investing in upskilling your employees internally. Is that an over or underrated business strategy?
I would say it's underrated. I would say it's underrated. I think that whether we like to admit it or not, the goal is to always outperform our best year or our best month as a small business. Because ultimately, the goal is we don't want to have our hands in the business. And I think, again, whether we want to admit it or not, that's the ultimate goal, that the business runs in itself and you put in the work that it's efficient enough that it can do that. And if we're going to get to that point, we have to invest in the team and we've got to get their skills up so that we can trust them enough to do some of the work that we're doing and make decisions because they're equipped to do, and we trust them to do that because of their skills. So underrated.
Okay. If you were forced to study something else other than business and go into the business field, what would you study?
Psychology.
Okay. Why?
I actually don't think that I'm going to go out without having studied that. I think that's one of my goals, to pursue a degree in that. Because I think that a lot of when we're talking about business, and for me as a consultant, that I do a lot of training and development and teaching entrepreneurial skills, right? And frameworks that are going to work. And no matter what group I'm teaching it to, sometimes I get the same small business owner or the same entrepreneur that asks very similar questions. And I think it has something to do with the way that people learn information and the way that some information is made priority for them to really hold on to, and some is not, as it relates to their business and what's most important for them to learn right now in this moment, right? Because the entrepreneur world is so volatile, you've got to get in and get out and quickly and make a decision. And so I think that having an understanding of that, I think would really make a difference with not just the way that I'm teaching people, but to understand better ways, maybe more efficient ways in which I can counsel or advice, or build curricula that would be even more impactful and more profound. Right now, one of the things that we do, because we do have a foundation in emotional intelligence, that's our core methodology and what we do anything with. And that's one of the biggest things that we strive for, is teaching very high level complex things in the most practical way possible so that it's very easily understood, whether it's someone that doesn't have a high school education or someone that does have maybe even a master's degree. And everybody is in the same playing with their level of understanding with that information. And so I think psychology, just the understanding of how people interact, behave, and think.
The next one, using freemium approaches to customer acquisition.
I think this one is a dual part. I don't think it's either underrated or overrated, and my response is going to be pretty long, so I'm just going to keep it tight. And what I'm going to say is sometimes when you don't have the audience or you haven't solidified your presence in the market, you have to find a way to do that. And that is a very unique strategy. A lot of businesses do it. It's effective for many of them. I would tell you that on the adverse of that, sometimes it can leave a sour taste in the client's mouth, because if you're give, why are you giving this to me for free if your business or product or service is supposed to be what you're telling me it is? So why are you
Yeah,
giving this
that's
stuff
a
to me for
great question.
So again, I think, and it's all subjective. It's almost, if I'm gonna I'm going to offer you a cookie if you come to the newest coffee shop. Our newest coffee shop, we'll call it Monet and Monet Maddox Cafe. And we're offering free cookies with the purchase of any coffee the last week of July. That's okay. I like that. But if we're just saying for the first 15 people who come in to the store, the last week of July are getting free coffee, and part of that is the free cookie as well. I'm okay. I don't really, yeah, no. How about no? People like exclusivity. When people like, human nature want, like, calls for us to want to have a desire to have the one up on information and things that are going to make an impact and things that are going to be different and that are going to be unique. And so we want that level of exclusivity. If you tell me that the coffee is $10 and you can sell me on the reason why I should buy it and I find value in that, I'm going to pay the $10, right? Because that's just, people want that. They have a desire for exclusivity and the enjoyment of something that is unique. And so I'm not necessarily sold on that. So I tried to keep that response tight, but sometimes it works for businesses, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm a big on obsess over quality and just focus on that. And then people will show up. If you make good stuff, people will be there to buy it from you. Last question. This is not over or underrated, but what's your favorite food in Spain?
How did you know? Okay, so I love the breakfast in Spain. So I don't know what it's called, but I'll describe it to you. And it's a breakfast bowl that we got 2 days in a row. My husband and I traveled to Spain in 2019. It's one of my I live in Spain at night in my dreams. So it's a bowl. And what it has, these organic mushed up potatoes with olive oil. And right above it is a over medium or over hard egg right above it. And right on the side of it, you have a grilled ham and the little piece of apple. And then they just put olive oil all over whatever kind of seasonings they use. I don't know. But that is my absolute most favorite meal or breakfast to have in Spain. I love their fish. I love their seafood there. There's nothing like seafood in Spain. But that breakfast was something so special. The portion was so small compared to what the kinds of portions we get here in the States. And just to have olive oil in the fashion which we did, right, to enjoy it actually with your spoon. And that was something I'd never done before. So I would recommend it to anyone. If you have the ability to have breakfast there, you're traveling to Spain, find, I don't know what the bowl is called, but if you have the ability to enjoy a bowl like that, where they've got the mushed potatoes, the olive oil, any of these things resonate with that dish, it's going to be that. And that is what I would recommend. And it's my absolute favorite.
Great. So we're going to jump into some kind of more Fresno related topics to wrap up now. And I want to start by talking, is it called One Main Financial or is it pronounced differently?
No, it's called One Main.
Okay. It was one word. So I wasn't sure if it had a different way you said it. But in any case, when you were working at One Main Financial, what were the most common reasons that people in Fresno were not receiving the loans that they were seeking?
It was, people like to say they didn't meet the credit requirements. It's always the credit requirements. But what I'll tell you is there was this term that lives in my head, rent-free, NDE, net disposable, NDI, sorry, net disposable income. And that was the primary reason why a lot of people did not qualify, because we needed to have a ratio of whatever income you brought home, not gross, but net, you had to have at least 60% of that income at that time. I think those were our guidelines, 60% of your income, net disposable. And I think even towards the tail end of my time there, I think it was close to 55, but it was a pretty significant amount that they required for you to have rent-free with no responsibilities tied to absolutely nothing. And that was very difficult because we have folks that would come in 700 plus credit score, 800 plus credit score, and their net disposable income was 30% of their income and 40% of their income. And that was not going to cut it. So that was difficult.
Yeah. And so then your perspective, if you're seeking credit, because people love cars in Fresno. I've noticed this since moving here. People love their cars. And so you get people with the two, especially in my neighborhood, I'll just see two brand new cars in the driveway. And I can make some evaluations in some respects. And I can assume that there's probably some auto loans attached to those. And so it's tough because we all want it all. But limiting yourself can really give yourself freedom to make big moves later when it comes to acquiring credit. So if you were giving someone some advice about how to make themselves attractive to someone, a lender, would it be to reduce the amount of debt on the books?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, and this is just a life philosophy that I, not philosophy, it was something I live by. It's everything's a sacrifice, right? You can't have the bigger fish without understanding what it takes to savor the 5 or 10 fish that you have. And so I think sometimes we want to go fast. We want to go high very fast. And sometimes that limits our capability. So I would say, yes, I would say, take a look at your bills, make a list, which ones are the most, because again, the higher the monthly expense is, the higher weight it carries on that net disposable income percentage, right? The amount you have left over, or you're going to have fully disposable. And so, you know, if you line them up like that, then you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to tackle, let's figure out, maybe you can't necessarily let go of the car loan. Maybe you can't necessarily pay it off in the next 2 or 3 years. But what you can do is you can assess that middle block of the list of expenses, right? And say, okay, this bill is $300 a month, $200 a month, $250. What is it going to take for me to eliminate these two or this one, or that's the goal for the next 6 months? So I always like to encourage that. Sometimes we want to, again, we want to be very aggressive and we want to say, okay, let me just pay everything off, or let me pay off the bigger thing first. And it's no, let's figure out a strategy that's going to work for you. And I would give that suggestion. And not everything is credit, right? Think about that, you know, as you're thinking about, if I do want to apply for a loan. And even, you know, sometimes, and I see this even with small business owners, because they're also applying. And remember, when you first start with your business, even though you might have an EIN, which is what the IRS requires, you may still not necessarily have established business credit. And so it depends on your credit. And so sometimes you can't even get a loan for your business to be able to buy whatever it is that you need to scale or grow or expand on in the restaurant or whatever, because of that, because they're looking at you being the person that's going to be responsible for the debt, right? Not necessarily your business, because you're new and it's your first business, or you don't have business credit. So it's very important not to just think about, am I paying the bills on time? But how about we cut down on some of the bills we're actually paying?
I know your role in this company was in operations, but I'm still curious. What did you learn about the Fresno real estate market working at Strategic REI?
So I learned that there is a ton of opportunity for real estate investors, first of all, because there is a huge gap. Something very unique that I learned in Fresno, Jordan, and I'll share this with you. There are a lot of properties that were purchased 20, 30, maybe even 40, 50 years ago, right? And sometimes people get excited. Oh, I bought this house now. I'm not going to touch it. I'm going to leave it alone for the next 15, 20 years. I'm not going to do anything to it. I'm just going to let the equity build. And so we see that being the actual same story that some of these Fresno residents had. And so you look up 15, 20 years from now, and now what happens is, yeah, you might have $300,000 in equity, but you don't have access to it. Why? Because one, you have very limited credit, right? Because maybe right now your company or your lender is asking for you to have a 720 credit score in order for you to establish a line of equity or to be able to pull and refinance on your property. So you don't even have access. It's very difficult to have access to that equity. And two, because you don't have access to that equity, you can't use your home as an actual asset and resell it for the actual valued price, because you don't have the ability to make the proper repairs to modernize the home so that it is actually resellable in the current market. And so what we saw a lot was that there is so much of that happening. And so you've got folks sitting on $300,000+ of equity, even more in some instances. And because they have a 680 credit score, 660, and the lenders are getting more stringent on what they're willing to offer according to the credit rating in terms of refinancing or credit lines, now these folks are in a dire situation where they need to access the equity in their home. And sometimes they have to sell the property as is, and they're robbing themselves of all those years that they paid of equity on that, and that the equity built up on the house. So sometimes there's the letting go of the house for $140,000, even though it's valued at $400,000, and a real estate investor comes in, puts $50,000 on the house and resells it for $450,000, and they paid it cash to you at that amount of the $140,000, and you really just needed $60,000 for your medical bills. So we saw that a lot when I worked at Strategic REI, where, and again, going back to your original question, it so happens that you just asked me about the NDI and being able to get loans. You know, owning a home, it's so much as a responsibility from the moment that you purchased it to the continuum of the time that you continue to maintain that property, because otherwise you're limited to the access. And then what tends to happen is you lose out on that because other people can't afford to make the fix things on, you know, in your home. And so that was one of the biggest trends that we saw, is that there's a lot of homes that have been documented to have a very high reselling value or value price, but unfortunately the residents there. And that's how real estate investors have a business, right? They have a business because of some of those folks and other challenging circumstances that sometimes arise. But for the most part, that was one of the biggest, I think, for me, an eye opener, that it's not just so much about you buy a house and you've now established an asset and you're done, or that's part of your retirement plan and that's your asset. But gosh, you know, there's just so much more to it, and the maintenance of the property and the upholding of your credit and the upholding of your NDI, so that the lender then 15, 20, 30 years from now can say to you, yes, you have access to that $300,000. And here's why, because you've managed to maintain your credit and you've kept your expenses low.
Let's imagine I made you the president of the Chamber of Commerce of Fresno for a week. What are two things you would do to help make Fresno a better environment for people starting businesses?
For people starting businesses, I think the very first thing that I would take them through is emotional intelligence classes. I think that we live in such a city where it's predominantly minorities. And so in such a unique city, you have such an opportunity for all of our minorities that reside here in Fresno are so passionate about seeing Fresno thrive and their businesses succeeding. And so I would want them to learn a little bit more about how they're interacting with their business and how they plan on interacting with their business moving forward. How are they practicing mindfulness in their decision-making? How are they reflecting? What habits are they building to make sure that they're assessing their strategy, they're assessing their people, they're assessing just the health of their operation, not just as it relates to the numbers once a month, but on a weekly basis. What are some of the things that they're doing that they can intercept so that they can take more proactive measures in their business instead of reactive? And we see, because we are predominantly minority here in Fresno, I think I read something like we're the 17th out of the nation's 50th highest poverty metropolitan areas. Even though we have so many businesses here in Fresno, I think most of the minority-owned businesses right now only have a revenue of under $100,000. So in order for them to scale and in order for us to make room to grow, we have to first start with us. So we've got to equip ourselves with all of the things that are going to enable us to inspire our teams, to inspire people, to know how to motivate people, to know how to train and develop people, to know how to communicate effectively, to know how to manage conflict resolution, right? I remember, and I say this because it's my experience, right? As a first gen and Mexican American, one of my biggest challenges was that in my very early on career, I was always perceived as extremely assertive. And it was because I was extremely driven and passionate. And so without my ability to refine that passion and that drive and be able to communicate in a way that I can inspire and I can motivate and I could be very clear in my communication, I don't think that I would have been as effective. And so I had to learn that the hard way along the way. I said the same thing to all three of them. Why did it rub those two the wrong way? So, and that's something that it's not necessarily a skill we're all equipped with. So we've got to learn it, especially as it relates to the new generations. They have a completely new demand of their expectation with companies that they're working for. And so if we're going to be able to inspire and motivate and be open to learn and be open and flexible to adapt, it has to start with us. So that's the first thing that I would do. If you were to tell me right now, you've got the keys, what are we going to do? We've got to put together an emotional intelligence. I don't know what we would call it, but it would be some type of certification that they would need to get through before they even get a permit and a license. Because we've got to know that they can hire people so that they contribute to the taxes in our city, right? And we can build and scale their company, because the ultimate goal is they want to make money and they don't want to be always managing that business. And so we know that to be the truth. So how do we do that? We start with us. We start with self. So that's what I would do.
Yeah. One of the last questions I have for you is a question I ask everybody. I work in education. That's my background. So I tend to see the world through that lens, both in the problems and the solutions. How does what you do affect the way Fresno, both in problems and solutions?
I think it allows for me to see gaps in the contribution to the economy of Fresno, first and foremost. And I think the second thing is because I also have children, and because I'm always reading and I'm always listening to what is happening in their schools, and constantly in a relationship or collaboration with their teachers, you know, about what they're seeing and trends. I think because of what I do, I can start to project out the challenges we may foresee in the small business world as it relates to such a unique city like Fresno. And so I think that's what it allows for me to do. It allows for me to see how the economy is being impacted and figure out or identify some gaps that are up and coming. And I remember, I'll say this to you, Jordan, maybe about 4 years ago, before I started my firm, I remember having a notion that technology was going crazy at that time. And I still didn't have a TikTok. I just opened up my first Instagram page since I was like, I think I had one when I was a teenager. And I opened it up last, I think it was November or October of last year. And I remember feeling 4 years ago that the human element of business was at the utmost, or had to be at the utmost of the priority for companies, because technology is inevitable, right? We need it. We absolutely need streamlined processes that are going to enable us to work faster at the speed and just rhythm that we're currently living our worlds, our day in the world now. But I remember thinking this human element is going to be so critical, and we need so much of it. And now fast forward 4 years, we're talking about emotional intelligence and what that means, being able to perceive people and their emotions and utilizing that information, managing through that information, understanding it so that we can lead people and we can make better decisions around people. And it's so amazing to me how full circle that is, because of some of the things I was seeing back then with the work I was doing and the consulting projects I was handling back then, which were very far in between. But I remember just being keen to that, the need for businesses to just be so alert about how they're interacting with people and keeping that social human element very much alive. So
we always close in the same place with books. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
So first and foremost, I'm always going to say the Bible. I'm always going to say the Bible. I read a book recently, called Discipline is Destiny. And it's actually turned out to be one of my most favorite books. I would also tell you The Big Leap is one that I read about 6 months ago. And it's also one that really challenged the way that I perceive how I interact with time. Yeah, so I really like The Big Leap. And also another big one, The Power of Positive Thinking, because I think we have to be resilient as entrepreneurs, as small business owners, and the world is changing so rapidly. So we've got to keep an open and positive mind. So I would say those.
Perfect. And can you tell us a little bit about MVM Advisory Group and what you guys do, some of the services you offer, and if people are interested in reaching out for a consultation, how they go about that?
Absolutely. So yes, MVM is a consulting firm. We specialize in helping companies scale and grow their businesses by using emotional intelligence as our core methodology. And so that means that we are very keen to how people respond, right? And how we are building strategy around our people and the impacts that those have. And we service academia. So we've built curriculum, we teach business, and we also serve as government. So we've done government work. We've worked with the Mexican consulate. We've worked with several nonprofits and that are focused on small businesses. And we also service commercials. So for any commercial business, small, medium size that needs support, we come in and we're able to help you grow and scale your company, meet you where you are. One of the things that we also do is we specialize in workshops. So one of the greatest and most fun things that form part of our job is doing that. It's interacting with people that want to learn something and us being able to facilitate that information. And so we have lots of fun doing that as well. So the way that you guys can get in touch with us, you can follow our Instagram page. It's actually businesshelp.mvm. So businesshelp.mvm. And also on our website at www.mvmadvisory.com.
Perfect. And we'll provide those links in the show description. Leslie, this has been so much fun. I have learned so much from you just in this hour and 15 minutes that we've been talking. I really appreciate you taking the time to share your insight and your knowledge with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jordan.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.